Welcome to the Meb Faber Show, where the focus is on helping you grow and preserve your wealth. Join us as we discuss the craft of investing and uncover new and profitable ideas, all to help you grow wealthier and wiser. Better investing starts here.
Meb Faber is the co-founder and chief investment officer at Cambria Investment Management. Due to industry regulations, he will not discuss any of Cambria's funds on this podcast. All opinions expressed by podcast participants are solely their own opinions and do not reflect the opinion of Cambria Investment Management or its affiliates. For more information, visit CambriaInvestments.com.
Hey, podcast listeners, welcome to a summer edition radio show. Jeff, welcome to the show.
What's happening?
You know, I figured we've done so many guest interviews and we were getting a lot of feedback where listeners were pining to get Jeff back on the show. So
as they should have been.
So we thought we'd start to mix up a few Q&As. We might even start doing 2 weeks. We'll see. Got a little travel coming up. Going to Colorado and Wyoming to see the eclipse.
Very nice.
Do you know there's eclipse coming?
This was Arnott was talking about that, right?
Yeah. So took his advice. Mainly got to go see the family in Colorado, but we also have family up in Wyoming. So we're going to pop up there and get to see the unadulterated 100% eclipse. Nice. You're only going to get about half here. Maybe you should come join.
What time you is ever it been supposed to, Wyoming? To be kicking in?
I think it's midday. I have no idea, though. Okay. You ever been to Wyoming?
Years ago, Jackson Hole.
Summer or winter?
Summer. Would love to ski there.
There's no way you'd go down Corbett's
Corbett's Couloir, yeah.
No, me neither. I've seen it.
No, well, just so listeners can understand, Meb and I ski from time to time, and you went off some...
I mostly wait for you.
You went off some ledge and told me the landing was fine, and I went flying over, and I remember trying to do some trick, and I about killed myself on the landing because it was anything but fine. It was all a mogul field down there. Actually, you didn't even jump it.
It was fine. It was
fine
for me.
You just skied down. No, I remember now. You actually didn't jump it. You skied around the side. Typical conservative, passive.
Maybe if you were using your 1980s purple Rossignols, you would have landed it.
I look great.
These newfangled skis don't work for you. What parabolics?
There you go.
You learned on the big cardboard ones. What are we talking about today? What do you know?
Back up first. You mentioned family a minute ago. Give us the update on Tony Huge and everything else from your end.
Things have gotten a lot easier. The first week of being a new father was kind of dark. Everything is wonderful now. I love it. It's a lot of fun. He's smiling, doing all the baby things he's doing. However, my brother, who I love dearly, just showed up with his three children. And it's been about one day. They're like 2 to 10. I'm just exhausted. We got a whole week to go. And then it's like an hour of just managing them. It's like, oh man, I'm even more and more impressed every day of parents of large families. It is chaos.
I have three nephews under the age of 10, and I made the big mistake of buying them these hard plastic swords for Christmas. And I bought myself one so we could battle. My, you know, shins and knuckles.
No, it's not a mistake for you because you can be fun uncle and leave.
Oh, yeah.
Your brother and family probably hates you forever. This year, you should show up with like a rubber band gun or something that's definitely going to cause tears and meltdown. All right. So that's good. We just put out our new book, you know, the best investment writing. So listeners, if you haven't picked it up, it's really a lot of fun. It's 30 curated pieces from this past year. We hope that I think it'd be really fun to do it as an annual volume. So kind of like those yearly, the best of science fiction writing, except their investment from, and it's from some of the best writers out there. I mean, the Jason Zweig intro piece alone is so awesome. Mm-hmm. That's worth the price of admission. Anyway, y'all pick up a copy. You can get it on Amazon. Let me know. We'd love to hear what you think. Do you think it's great, terrible, things new to add? The Kindle edition, everything is in color, by the way, which is pretty cool. You don't rarely see that where they do the black and white hardcover Kindle in color. Check it out. Let us know. In the cover, there's no book jacket. It's like a material unknown to man. I've never felt as nice of a book cover. You guys, let me know what you think. Well, I thought it was a lot of fun.
I would think, too, if you guys hearing this are familiar with some great authors that you believe might be worthy of consideration for volume two that we missed, let us know. We're always looking for great pieces.
Yeah, so we'll do a Q4. We'll do a crowdsource. Send us the single best thing you read in 2017. And that way I'd like to see a lot more breadth of writers. I mean, we got a lot of unknown and super well-known writers in this one. Everything from, you know, billion-dollar fund managers to journalists to everything in between, bloggers. So yeah, we hopefully we'll be volume two will be out in Q1.
Cool. All right, let's jump in here. I was thinking today, something you've recently done, obviously, is you opened up your calendar to some investors and to some RIAs, offering them the chance to call in and basically just chat with you for 30 minutes or so. And I know from speaking with you over the last couple weeks, there was a lot of commonality or some commonality in terms of what they're asking about and how they're seeing the markets and their concerns. Can you give us the high level about you know, what their thoughts were? That's probably representative of how a lot of listeners are seeing things.
Yeah, so we call this office hours, and podcast listeners, you wouldn't have heard about it unless you're on our email list. So join through any of the websites. And we sent it out and I said, look, my summer's sort of slow. I'm a new dad. I got some time to kill during the day. And I just wanted to interact with clients, would-be clients, people, right? And so...
By the way, how many hours did you...
Well, so it was 2 weeks long. And my intention was to do like a professor does, office hours this time over these 2 weeks. And I used this calendar scheduling app. And I meant for it to be from 10 to 2 every day. So around lunch to hang out, have 4 30-minute conversations. Or no, that's 8. Anyway, I unintentionally left my calendar open from 9 to 4 every day. So I did 10 to 12 calls a day for 2 weeks, back to back. And it was...
I haven't seen Med look this tired.
So if you heard me by... I'm not a huge talker in the first place. So if you heard me...
That's false.
If you heard me by the final Thursday or Friday, I sounded like a frog. My voice just so gravelly. But it was awesome. So I talked to people... 30-minute calls and all walks of life. We talk to people from Russia, Venezuela, Saudi Arabia, Florida, Oregon. Almost all the callers, there was like half the callers were from Oregon for some unknown reason, where it's like 110 degrees right now. Anyway, but it was about half individuals and half advisors or institutions. I would say about 1/3 of the calls were just talking about the Broncos or fishing or whatever's going on in the world. 2/3, you know, enter business opportunities, some of our podcast ideas, some of our million-dollar fintech ideas. But 2/3, there's the common themes of kind of what you alluded to at the beginning, which was what's going on in markets, what's going on in the world, how best do you think we can either implement some of your ideas or funds or offerings or concepts into our practice or portfolio? And there was probably 3 or 4, you know, kind of things that I'd say. I would always start it off, we'd just chat for a while, and then I'd say, look, what's on your mind? And kind of just wanted to get a survey of what people were thinking, you know, and in the general just feedback, what's sentiment, what's going on in the world. And most people, there's kind of a couple takeaways. A lot of people, I think, going back to, if you remember our original conversation near the beginning of the year where we talked about the zero budget portfolio, a lot of people still have a ton of baggage in their portfolios. And there's a, what's it called? The endowment effect, where you value something higher that you currently own. You know, a lot of people have these legacy positions, and for whatever reason, they treat them totally different than if they had a full account of cash and just wanted to go allocate. So their starting point is always, this is what I own now, and I want to move to B. So I'm at A, and I want to move to B. And I think it's really hard for people to say, well, let's exclude taxes considerations for a minute, but let's say you had a just broad portfolio where nothing was, you weren't going to generate a huge tax gain. But let's say you just had a bunch of junk in there, 20 mutual funds that you didn't know what to do with. You know, it's really hard for people to go from there because they treat what they own differently than what they want to own. And so we often just say, just clean house, liquidate it, and then focus on where you want to be. Anyway, so that was a common theme, a lot of baggage.
Well, how much of that is people not understanding their investments fully, or the markets change, so what they bought X years ago that might have made sense then is no longer, you know, something that they want to hold, versus it's just purely a behavioral bias? You know, they're basically just saying, I don't care, I now value this more, as you said, because the endowment effect.
I think it relates a little bit more to my second point, which is that most people are still winging it.
Okay.
And just shooting from the hip. And I should have asked this question in the next office hours. And by the way, we'll do this probably once a quarter from 10 to 2, not 9 to 4, but 10 to 2. And, you know, the vast majority of people, some did, but almost majority of them didn't have like a written, structured, rules-based plan, most people say, well, I own some of this and I own some of that, and I'm thinking about doing this and that. And it's the way my universal experience is the way almost everyone manages money, including advisors and institutions. They kind of just assimilate new information every day and just kind of roll with it, right? They don't have like a written investment plan that, and we think everyone should, that which you can then deviate from. Because once you have a reasonable investment plan, and I said this to almost every call we did, I said, look, you know, first of all, let me say, there's a lot of great ways to invest. I said, look, I'm happy to talk about Trinity and all these other ideas that we have, but there's plenty of good ways to invest. I said, you know, this may be a scenario where you're happy to sit in CDs, and or you have your 10 dividend stocks that you've held for 20 years, and that's your thing, and you're comfortable with it. I'm like, that's fine. I'm happy to talk about the ways that I think are the best ways to invest, but let it be known, the most important thing is to find the investing strategy that's right for you. And a lot of people, I think, get stuck in this rut of age-based investment strategies. So say I'm a 20-year-old, I have to be aggressive because I have a long-term time horizon. But then you have a 20-year-old that hasn't studied market history or is super emotional and can't handle losing more than 10% of their investment account. And so you put them, you know, an advisor then puts them 100% in stocks and they go down 50% and that person is scarred for 20 years. Like, they're not going to invest. I had a lot of calls, by the way, where it was people that were aware of their behavioral issues. They're like, look, I'm my own worst enemy. I said, that's great. That's a huge finding. At least you know. But they would say, I was devastated by 08. I've never gotten back into investments since, and I'm sitting on cash or whatever. And that was a common theme. And so going back to the age-based thing, I said, there's also 80-year-olds that I talk to that say, look, I got $5 million. I'm not going to spend it. I spend like $50,000 a year. So I would like to invest this intelligently, but also invest it. It's only going to one of three places. It's going to the government, it's going to your kids, or some sort of foundation or charity, right? Like, it's going to get dispersed. Mm-hmm. Can't take it with you. So as my mom always says, so they said, I would like to invest fairly aggressively, but most, you know, kind of the old school, just age-based investment styles would say that you need to be conservative. You're old, you know, which, although if you go back to the Edelman podcast, 80 is no longer old. They may be living to 120 now, but yes.
Well, tell me this, you mentioned kind of the root of this was too many investors don't have a written investment plan. When I think of that, I wonder if investment plan, just that term, has a certain amount of ambiguity and or fear attached to it to the common investor, because they're like, well, what does that mean? Do I need a 3-page written outline? Do I need to be able to forecast what I'll do in every situation? Right now, can you give us maybe just 3 basic questions to ask yourself, or 3 rules of thumb to come up with a basic investment plan to know what might work for you?
Well, I don't even think it has to be written. I just think you need to have some sort of plan.
All right. Well, then, but let me paint you to a corner. What are 3 questions to help you arrive at your own plan?
So let me tell you what the conversation I would have with people, and then we'll see if we can figure out 3 questions from this.
All right.
Because I don't know that I had 3 off the top of my head. I could come up with them. But so the conversation would usually lead to, hey, Meb, all right, so here's what my current situation is. Here's my allocation, or here's what my clients are doing. Can you tell me a little bit about the way you see the world and sort of this Trinity concept and et cetera? And so I say, look, again, there's lots of great ways to invest. And I say, one great way to invest, what we call the starting point almost always, is what we call an investable benchmark, is if you just went out and bought the world, if you just bought everything in the world, what would that percentage look like? And we call it the global market portfolio. And it's, you know, a big mix of U.S. stocks and foreign stocks and bonds and real estate and commodities, everything in between. You're going to be owning, you know, 50,000 plus securities around the world. You just bought everything. And it ends up roughly like half and half stocks and bonds if you were to lump everything into one category. You know, corporate bonds is sort of a mix, tips are a mix, and everything in between. But in general, it's roughly a 50-50. And so we say, all right, that's the market cap portfolio starting point. That's kind of like the bar from which we start point. The beautiful thing about that today is you can invest in that for almost no cost, or essentially very almost free.
Why is that the bar? It seems like all you're really getting is global diversification. Why is that sort of the settings point?
That's my default starting benchmark.
Just
okay,
for just me, because you need something.
For me, that's my starting benchmark, right? Because it's a great portfolio.
It is.
And it's low cost. You get No home country bias. You get the market cap portfolio. If you were to just buy the world, it's the starting point. So there's a lot of ways to do that. Obviously, we have one of the lowest cost ETFs in the industry that does this. But you know, if you were to buy a number of different global asset allocation funds that cost very little, or the robo-advisors. This is what all the robo-advisors do. Buy and hold diversified portfolio. And I said, but the problem with that, there's a couple problems. I said, the biggest challenge for that for people is drawdowns. And you go through a bear market like you did in 08, 09, 2000, 2003, and investors really struggle with drawdowns. And it's not just because the portfolio draws down and you lose 10, 20, 30, you know, like some endowments that are a little more aggressive, 50%. You know, a lot of people, their drawdowns were 50% in 08, 09. But it's also because it coincides with recessions, with people losing their jobs, so a bad economy often, and tons of negative news flow. So all of this happens at the same time as you're having a bear market. So if bear markets are happening, you know, right, like when times are good and economy's great and everyone's full employment, that's not the way it works. It all usually happens at once. So it's really hard to sit through those. And we'll ignore the market cap differences right now. So that's the biggest challenge of the buy and hold. And then the minor differences are they're market cap weighted. So you could tilt towards value. You could tilt towards momentum. We talk about this in the Trinity Portfolio White Paper. And I said, well, you know, if you've known me long enough, you know that my philosophy, one of the longest things that we do at Cambria is, you know, trend following at heart. And trend following is a great investment approach, but it's also hard to comply with. And it's hard for other reasons. It's hard because you often look different. So it may be underperforming when buy and hold is outperforming or when the S&P is ripping. And so it's hard emotionally to stick with that system because your friends may be making money. Your friends may, or your coworkers, everyone else is doing great. So the whole Trinity concept, we said, is the combination of the two. It's a little holistic, like a yin-yang sort of combination. And I said, that's been the best way that if you look back at a decade of sort of research for us on holistically putting together buy and hold as a fundamental anchor, you know, so you always have some tether to what's going on in the economy in the world, but also this trend following component that hopefully can give you concentrated exposure as well as some risk management if and when we may never have another bear market here, but if and when in the US we have another bear market. So that was kind of the summary starting point. And then a lot of people, we went off down 10,000 other tangents. Another comment, until you let me know you have another question.
Yeah, let me interrupt then if you got a second. As I'm listening to this, I'm trying to think about how this would potentially translate into the idea of a few common questions or whatnot to help listeners come up with their investment plan. And my mind's thinking, well, it kind of boils down to an investor's personal preference in between more risk and return, less risk return, that sort of thing. So it would slide between buy and hold versus active. But to what extent have you seen that investors, in a sense, delude themselves? In a market like right now, they're sitting there thinking, all right, well, I wouldn't mind ramping up my risk return, so I'm going to slide more towards active or whatever to because I can handle a 30% drawdown. But then when it comes, people get scared and you know every bit of logic they have in moments like this goes out the window, and then they're just fleeing the investment plan. So how do you kind of plan ahead for the behaviors and the fears that invariably kick in?
And one of the biggest mistakes, I think, the vast majority of the conversations I had, almost everyone, someone had a question or is stressing about something, an investment, and they see it as a binary choice. So I know US stocks are expensive. Should I be in them or out? I know that I've been out of the market since 08, 09. Should I get back in? Mm-hmm. In almost every conversation, it was either in or out, no in between. And I would often tell people, I said, look, you know, my dad used to struggle with this. He's like, oh man, I own silver, but should I sell it or keep it? And I said, sell a quarter of it.
Yeah.
It's not as much fun. You're not going to be gambling. A lot of people want something to cheer for. They want a lottery ticket. So they want the excitement or drama of investing. And that's not sensible. You know, that's not the really smart way to do it. So many people, I said, look, let's say you've been out since 09 and you want to start putting money to work. I said, why don't you dollar cost average in over the next 5 years? And you can always avoid the hindsight. I mean, the correct mathematical choice is almost always lump sum immediately because the portfolio has positive expected return. And we're not to the point yet where a portfolio doesn't. A 60-40 US only has a very low expected return. And we had some really insightful questions on Twitter the other day. We can talk about in a minute about that. But in general, people only wanted to think in terms of, should I be in or out? And I said, look, let's say even if it was a binary choice, you want to be in or out of US stocks. I said, you know, sell a quarter of it, sell a third, or dollar cost average in. It doesn't have to be something where you're either in or out. But if we were to, you know, to boil down to the top three, it's really about finding the portfolio that's right for you, which is in and of itself a hard challenge. If you remember back to the Bernstein podcast, he's like, I estimate 99.9% of people can't manage money on their own.
Yeah.
You know, because a lot of people that even once you know your risk tolerance, you know, that requires one, a knowledge of history to understand what markets have done. I mean, if you were to tell most people this on this podcast that US stocks have declined 80%+ before, NASDAQ declined, I think 85% in the 2000 bear market, they would find that to be surprising. You know, that's a way more risk than they would expect. And two, it's hard to tell someone the risk that hasn't been through it, that hasn't experienced a 50% down move or 80, 90%. So there's disconnect, you know, education gap, experience gap for the younger people or people just haven't been through it. So, but eventually the goal is to try to find something that's right for you. Subcorollary would be take less risk than more. So if you think here's your level of what you want, add some cash. Because I guarantee you no one ever will go down their grave and say, man, if I had that 7% return instead of 6. But living through that massive drawdown to get to the extra return, you know, the path to get there is really hard for most people. And so just coming up with something simple and then starting small. Like, you don't have to go all in if you're in or out. Anyway.
Yeah, I like that. The idea of scaling in seems like it could help a lot from the emotional side of it.
Yeah. So anyway, we'll come up with three ideas, and that'll be the next radio show. Top three suggestions for a allocation. But, you know, there's a lot of other things. I mean, I think a lot of people, if you were to probably poll the average wealth and, you know, investment size of the listeners of this podcast or the people I talk to, if you have something like $30,000, you're in the world's top 1%. If you have $30,000 in your name, you're a 1%er. So almost everyone listening to this podcast, almost everyone that I talk to, but it's always interesting to talk to people. And in the US, I think that number is up around 700 grand, 800 grand. Let's call it a million. Let's round up. If you're a millionaire, you're in top 1%. But we also saw a study that's like, they would ask people what money would it take for them to be happy. And regardless of asset size, it was like triple. So I talked to everyone on the podcast, I mean, on the calls. It didn't matter if they had $10,000, a million. Some people had $100 million to their name. Advisors managing billions. People, family offices, these huge one sovereign wealth fund, everything in between. And it's interesting the perspectives because they all have some very similar concerns. And it's just in general, what should I do with my money? Mm-hmm. How should I invest? And the takeaway is there's a lot of great ways to do it. There's a lot of really, really, really terrible ways to do it. Could probably talk about cryptocurrencies here. I just got one of my favorite books, Extraordinary Popular Delusions and the Madness of Crowds. If you're a listener and you haven't read that book, I encourage you to go read it. You should also read our Bubbles paper. What's it called? What if
Sir Isaac Newton was a trend follower?
What if Isaac, yeah, was a trend follower? And it's a history of some bubbles. And it's really interesting because so many of these initial coin offerings and cryptocurrencies, there's so many similarities to historic bubbles right now. A lot of go read our old white paper. And there was this great, great event. I can't remember what it was, but this guy was doing these, essentially like these initial public offerings where people would invest. And back then, like, you didn't even know what the venture was going to be. And I can't remember the quote. It's like for a venture to be described later. So people would investing all this money and they have no idea what they're investing in. And you see this now with so many of these initial coin offerings. People literally have zero idea what they're investing in. And you start to see stuff like this. There's a website called What If Bitcoin. And the only thing the website is, you type in how much money, if you had invested $100 in 2015, what would it be worth today?
Oh, gosh.
So it is a giant and then Bill Winterberg tweeted this. It's a giant fear of missing out machine, which is what fuels bubbles. Mm-hmm. I was talking to Jeff at lunch today about a cryptocurrency that had gone up 10,000% or something.
18,000%.
Right. And so that's what gets people starting to drool. But if you were to ask me, I'd say, look, man, you should probably get a lot more interested in early stage microcap or angel investing because you have the same orders of magnitude possible returns. We're doing one upcoming with a famous venture angel coming up soon. At least those companies have potential to generate cash flows in my mind. So you guys understand my perspective on the crypto world. I previously was presently amused. Now I'm viewing it more and more as a giant dumpster fire for investors to lose a boatload of money. But so not a lot of cryptocurrency conversations, but I had a few.
All right. Let me back up really quick. I didn't want to interrupt your train of thought a moment ago, but I'm curious. You were talking about how the global portfolio is your starting point for anything. And I kind of questioned why. And you said, what's a great portfolio? I don't know if you have the numbers in front of you, but how does the global portfolio do on a return basis, a long-term return basis compared to like the S&P?
Great. So if you read our global asset allocation book, it will show you, we got a chapter on the global market portfolio. And by the way, the reason I say it's the default is because it's literally the default. It is the global market cap. If you were to buy the world, that's what it is. It's in line with almost every other asset allocation portfolio in the book, which is, you know, does 9 or 10% a year historically back to the 70s or whenever we started the study, and like 5 or 6% real. So in line, low volatility. It's like 10% return, 10% volatility, you know, 20 or 30% drawdown or something nominal. And then real is a little bit different. So it's right in the middle of everything. So it's perfectly, wonderfully average.
It's weird. I mean, in so many ways, it seems like investing is not that challenging. We just overcomplicate it so much by trying to find the various tilts and whatnot that are going to add a little bit of alpha when all you really have to do is go out and buy the global portfolio and hold long enough and keep your expenses low.
And we have this portfolio. It's the only ETF that doesn't charge a management fee. We don't talk hardly ever on this podcast about funds or strategies or, you know, offerings, but you know, there's a number of these low cost ETFs that exist. And we talked about it in a blog post a while back. We said there's something like four, probably now about six of these asset allocation ETFs that are under 0.3% all in, and each of them owns 20,000 securities around the world, and they're all good choices. And I can't remember who runs the rest. I think it's BlackRock or State Street. Under 30 basis points. And there's something like collectively $2 or $3 billion in them. But there's something like 700 mutual funds that charge more than that, many 1, 2, even 3%, and they manage almost $1 trillion. So that if you're going to do buy and hold low cost investing, global market portfolio, you should pay as little as possible because by definition, you're not doing anything.
Yeah.
You're just buying the world. And so that's a generational change. And I don't know when you may see the blockbuster Netflix moment. You know, where all of a sudden, like you're seeing these everyday articles about flows in low cost, flows in the passive, but you haven't, I mean, that's a perfect example. And even this year, there's been more mutual funds launched than ETFs. I think a lot of people don't touch on some of these, you know, they say, oh, ETFs, passive, all this stuff. And active management's, you know, hitting near all time highs in AUM. So all this stuff, it will be a generational change. And I think to myself, I said, I wonder what would be the next, what would be the blockbuster moment? And I don't know what it is, but because I think a lot of these high fee funds are just stuck in brokerage accounts where people forgot about them. They're dead, you know, and it's going to take 10, 20 years to wash it out.
I mean, it could be the generational wealth transfer that's happening now when it could happen over the next decade. You know, as you get these 75, 80 year olds, 85, 90 year olds who are going to pass on their portfolios to their kids, I would hope or think that there would be some level of further analysis of the actual investments. And if, you know, the people who are inheriting these are seeing they're getting charged, you know, 125 bips versus what they could be in for 25 bips, you know, especially with a stepped up cost basis, it's not as prohibitive to liquidate and then move into something else now.
It's something like one in five people that inherit or result of divorce get an account from their parents or husband, wife. One in five stay with the advisor. So almost everyone leaves. But so just as I would hope for any rationality on the younger generation caring about low costs, you know, you see Robinhood, you know, these no transaction fee brokerage account, which is now valued at over $1 billion, you know, tons of investors using that to act great. People care about costs. And then you realize that something like 90% of Robinhood's clients bought Snapchat on the day it IPO'd. So they learned some lessons, but not the right ones, you know. So they're low cost, you know, just throwing all their money into a fireplace. Yeah, but
we talked about this earlier, where they didn't get picked up by the S&P. So it's just another further slap to them. Yeah. It's gonna hurt.
Yeah. So what else you got?
All right, well, have we exhausted the majority of the topics which were, you know, brought to you in these phone calls?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of conversations like, okay, Meb, what do you see in the world? Where do you see the opportunities? And I'd say, you know, look, the thesis we've had for the past 4 or 5 years has been consistent. It has been the U.S. is one of the more expensive markets in the world, and foreign is much cheaper. Some parts of it are incredibly cheap. And you really started to see that message come to life, which has been kind of nice. So we went through the pain of 2014, which was foreign stock markets were bottoming. And since then, 2015, 2016, 2017 in particular, a lot of these markets have really started to get the momentum. And so even though the U.S. is still bull market, hitting new highs, one of the longest bull markets we've ever seen, it's ceded leadership and performance to the foreign markets. So I get a little pat on the back. I'm excited about that, to see last year it was Russia and Brazil. This year it's almost everything. A lot of Europe, a lot of emerging Europe. A lot of countries are having monster years in their stocks. And so you have this global uptrend in equity markets, right? Commodities are a mixed bag. You have, real estate as far as REITs are a mixed bag. They're at super low yields, though they've had pretty good, they've been one of the best performing asset classes since the bottom. Bonds, you've seen our thesis of looking for value in sovereign bonds to be working out great. So a lot of this is kind of, the world looks much more like it should to us over the past few years, which is good. But usually that's when it starts to surprise you again. So
let's dig into U.S. equities for a second. A term I've heard thrown around recently is the melt up. And obviously we're overvalued, as I've heard you say many times, doesn't mean we're going to suffer any sort of massive drawdown tomorrow. But if you're playing this as a numbers guy, odds are not good that we're going to continue at these levels for an extended period. You don't know, but it would seem to suppose that. So, but given this whole melt-up concept, are you familiar with, past bull markets where we've been at an approximate stage here where you can sort of say, all right, well, this might be another 6 months of explosions, and we, any investors who get in now can take care of it. And I mean, it's in a sense a market timing question, which you can never answer.
I would love one day to have, there's a handful of people I'd love to have on this podcast and ask them this question. And you can use any valuation metric. So if you looked at all the valuation metrics in the U.S. stocks, they all say they're expensive. There's not a single one I can find that says stocks are cheap. Okay. And it's varying degrees. So some metrics like the median stock in the S&P 500, so the middle, the price to sales or cash flow or earnings ratios, those are all at all-time highs. Not, top decile, all time, higher than 2000. Other metrics that we look at, we talk a lot about 10-year price earnings ratio, so CAPE ratio. It's not anywhere near bubble all-time highs, which was 45 or 48, I think it hit March of 09, December 1999.
Wait, where are we now, 30?
We're 30-ish, yeah, a little over 30. So it's high, but it's not horrific. It's been as low as 5, as high as 45. It's been as high as almost 100 in Japan. So if Elon Musk starts his boring company and finds, kryptonite under the crust of the Earth's surface and, causes this rally to go from 30 to 50 or 100, like, it's possible. That's been seen before. But here's the challenge. So a couple different ways you can approach equity markets, and one in particular. But so I asked this question on Twitter. It's a three-part question. Part one, do you own U.S. stocks currently? So at a valuation of 30, CAPE, 90% said yes, okay? So we forecast U.S. stock returns to be low single digits. Not negative, better than bonds, but certainly nowhere near foreign stock returns or other asset class. Two, I said, would you continue to own U.S. stocks if they hit a CAPE ratio of 50, which is the highest they've ever been in 140 years that we have data? And it was like two-thirds said yes, they would continue to own stocks at a point of which no person with common sense there's no objectable evidence that investment would have a positive return. So in history, in our global database, we're looking at every market that's hit 50. So China and India were in the 40s and 60s, I think in the mid 2000s, Japan, US, there's a handful of others, right? The once you hit 30 is like a yellow flashing light, like it's times are going to be pretty meh. Mm-hmm. 40 is your returns are going to be negative. And anything above that, it just gets worse. And so the third quiz was, if CAPE ratio hit a value of 100, would you continue to own U.S. stocks? And I think it was like a third said yes. And the funny thing is if you frame this a different way, and here's how to put it in good perspective for people. Take your house down the street. Say, you know, it's worth 500 grand. And that's a reasonable ratio and metric based on square footage and price to income, like a bunch of the metrics you could come up with. It's mm-hmm. any person would think would be reasonable. Say it's 500 grand. Say, all right, would you pay $1 million for this house? Like zero people would say yes. You know, and then would you pay $2 million for this house? You know, and so people for some reason take a different approach to investing. I mean, you're investing in businesses at the end of the day. And people take a very strange approach when it comes to investing in businesses that happen to be listed on a stock exchange. And so the question I'd love to ask, you know, Bogle or some other, you know, really awesome market participants is there a point in which you would say this is too much?
All right. Well, I'm going to stop you and I'm going to ask that question of you. Let me back up here. We're at a CAPE of 30 right now. Given what you know about the upward momentum in the U.S. market right now, given what you know about historical valuations and where they often start going south, at what CAPE level are you going to bail on U.S. equities before they turn south? You're just going to get out because you think it's too high.
Two comments, or maybe like five. I always come up with a number with them when I have response. I'm like, three things. And I haven't even thought of the three things yet. I just have to find a way to get
Stop
three
waffling
things.
Stop waffling and let me just, things. You know.
So I have an investment approach. I've very well talked about, disclosed that I put all of my investable public assets into Cambridge Strategies and portfolios. So for me, I have, you know, it averages out to like a Trinity 3 or 4. So right in the middle. And a Trinity 3 or 4 means I have roughly half in buy and hold and half in trend following. Remember, the buy and hold side tilts towards value. So any of the global funds are going to tilt away or not own the U.S. at all. And not only that, those funds start to move to cash if nothing is cheap in the world. But remember, the good news is there's a lot of cheap stuff and a lot of really cheap stuff. Cheap bucket has a CAPE ratio of around 11 right now, which is a third the U.S., and the average country, I think, is around 20 or 22 maybe. But foreign developed and emerging are cheaper. So the really cheap stuff is way cheap. And then the other half of the bucket is trend following, of which, you know, some is managed futures, some hedges based on value and moment and trend. So the strategies that take macro value into account own zero or are hedged. So they hedge out the value part. With the last part being price-based only, that owns U.S. stocks, but it won't as soon as they turn over. My point is I have systems to get rid of the U.S. equities if and when they need to be, a lot of which are value-oriented.
All right, let me stop you there then. Just patronize me. We have a lot of listeners out there who are probably long U.S. equities without the various tilts and trend following overlays and whatnot. Let's assume you, Meb, were carrying just a basket of long U.S. equities. At what CAPE level would you get scared and sketched out and you would just go ahead and sell?
Let's say that I'm a investor that has all my money in U.S. stocks and I'm a stock guy.
Yep.
You know, I invest in stocks based on the nonsensical dividend approach. And that's what I do. Going back to our earlier conversation of behavioral issues, I think it would be irresponsible to tell everyone that they should think in binary terms after just saying not to. So, however, I think you like here's a reasonable, totally reasonable approach. Be like, look, I'm going to invest in U.S. stocks, but if they hit a certain value, I'm going to cut it to 50%. Mm-hmm. If they hit another value, I'm going to cut it to 25%. But, you know, so that I can avoid my FOMO or hindsight regret. So if they hit 40, like some, and you can even do it in buckets. You say, if they hit 30, I'm going to go down to 75%. Hits 40 or 50, I'm going to go down to 50. And maybe that's the lowest you ever go, you know, if that's the way you think. And if they go to 100 or 80, you know, I'm going to go down to 20%. Yeah. And that's a reasonable, like, that's just a common sense checkbox. Anyway, but that also implies a world we live in right now where there's so many, it's so funny to hear the media say, and a lot of portfolio managers, they're like, you know, we live in a world where there's no other choices. Like U.S. stocks or bonds, usually one isn't in a bubble, but they both look terrible now. And I'm like, what are you talking about? Every foreign stock market in the world, half of them are really, really, really cheap. Mm-hmm. So it's there's better choices anyway.
I met someone recently, and she had told me how she's putting, or she had just gotten professional help from a broker that she was really excited about, and her money was finally saved up, and she's really pumped about a portfolio. And when she found out that I was, you know, somewhat involved in the business, she goes, "Oh, well, let me show you what I have. What do you think?"
This sounds like a date, by the way. Shouldn't come up on a first date, Jeff.
So she showed me what they had
put
her in.
Don't worry. We have no female listeners to this podcast. If my Twitter analytics are evidence of this podcast, we are 90% men. The other 10% are robots.
Yeah, we got to work on that, by the way. Anyway, so she showed me what they had put her in. And right now she's holding 40% U.S. equities.
Mm-hmm.
And... And she said, "This is great, isn't it?" And my,
what's the other 60%?
I think she was 20%
foreign equities.
20% foreign equities.
No, almost no default advisor or allocation ever gets the equity percentages in my mind right.
Well, I mean, I agree, but my point on the, she was all excited about how the portfolio had done as well, and I said, "Well, you have to keep in mind that we're in a pretty intense bull market and a rising tide." Lifts all ships or whatever. And she didn't really understand what that meant. But my point was, look, the returns at this level, you got to look more globally. Stock, see who's rejecting.
Right. Sounds now. Like Jeff went out with a 22-year-old and is using analogies from the 1980s. That, do you remember Family Ties?
Do you think it's reasonable that a professional money manager would have put her right now, she started this portfolio within the last year, 40% U.S. equities?
Yeah, it could be. I mean, it depends on what the other 60% is. I mean, it could be like if it's 40% U.S. and 20% foreign and 50% bonds or 40%
do that
bonds.
Math again.
I mean, like it could be reasonable because, you know, it depends. If you're saying, look, this is a 50-year time horizon and, you know, I 40% equities could be fine. You know, I just, it's not what I would do, but it's not.
Again,
U.S. is not. Let me also add, in addition to Trinity, you know, I have 10% of my portfolio on tail risk strategies focused on the U.S. stock market. So, you know, that goes a lot to say that, I mean, that is there's not a single listener on this podcast that has that much, or any professional advisor I know that has that much in tail risk strategies. So that tells you a little bit about how I think about the world.
What's that drag right now?
Well, just it depends. You can't put a cost on that. I mean, historically, we did a couple blog posts, and a white paper should be out by the time this podcast comes up that looks at tail risk strategies that pairs S&P 500 puts with 10-year government bonds. And it actually shocked me, but the historical returns were actually positive. So it did something like 2% a year back to the 1980s. But there's a pretty big bond bull market during that period. So I think a reasonable expectation would be no return to even, you know, potentially negative, but, you know, we're at, I think, a good starting point. I mean, it's like the lowest volatility on record right now. And by the way, if you went back 8 months and said, you know, the day after the Trump election, that we would then have some of the least volatile equity markets ever, no one would have taken that bet. You could probably have gotten 100-1, 1,000-1 on that. You know, and that's just such a great example of markets confounding almost everyone's opinion at the time. And you go back, I'll take a little credit. You go back and this is my second backslap during this episode. You go back and read my tweets around the election. And a couple of them was like, look, you know, I hate to tell people, but, you know, these presidential election is mostly irrelevant to future returns.
Well, yeah, we wrote that article about the analogy was the mosquitoes and the lions and what people were afraid of.
Great article.
Yeah.
Although I say that with showing up to work today with a huge spider bite on my face. So if I don't make it to September, you know that a venomous something got to me. Yeah, I mean, and I agree. Is what people, a lot of the stuff that people worry about is not what they should be worrying about.
A few moments ago, you mentioned some insightful Twitter questions when we were talking about US 6040. Did we cover that, or was that a different...
Yeah, that was it. That was the poll okay. Right, I gave.
Cool. All right. Before moving on, then, we've touched on a lot of the stuff from, I guess, mom-and-pop investors who are calling you. Anything that you would find or we would find interesting from advisors who called you, or is it mostly the same stuff?
I think a lot of people are interested in... some kind of the bucket of other, you know, so a handful of the podcasts we've done with like Pierce Street and Roofstock, we had a lot of feedback. People seem to love those. Real estate's kind of my nightmare. I don't like anything that involves a hassle, despite y'all having heard me talk about owning farmland in Kansas that burned down a year or two ago. Good news is, update, I got an insurance check for it, by the way.
Was this the combine fire?
Yeah. Combine randomly caught fire and burned down entire, it's like the highest per acre bushel yield we've ever had on the farm, by the way. So yeah, I mean, it's not a particularly good, you know, super high yielding investment, but there's a lot of sentimental value. We like going out to the farm. I just got a photo of my nephew with like a 6 foot long rattlesnake, headless, by the way. Anyway, so anything that involves, you know, big hassle for me, it doesn't really fit the bill. But a lot of people want to talk about other ideas and different things, and that's really fun for me. I mean, I love the concept of liquid alts. I like illiquid alts less, except for, I think angel investing is a really fun, interesting, you know, area, largely for a couple of reasons that most people don't know about. And we're gonna have Jason on the podcast here soon, but a couple of the biggest reasons being, it one potentially eliminates a lot of your emotional choices because you can't sell the investment. You have no choice. Second, there's a huge, huge tax advantage that we'll talk about probably in the upcoming episodes, but essentially shields your capital gains from the first $10 million. So if you hold it for 5 years. Hmm. So even if you just replicate the S&P in your angel account, there's a massive tax benefit. Lastly would be that you have the potential for these 100x investments. And so, because angel investments in general, because you're under, say, 50 million or 20 million market cap. So if you invest in something at 10 million, it's a lot easier for something to go from 10 million to 100 to a billion, which we call unicorn. That's 100 bagger, much like your crypto. And they could even go to 10 billion, in which case it's 1,000 bagger. I mean, that is a massive logarithmic increase in wealth. So even if you put in 10 grand into an angel investment at 10 million, right, it hits a billion, that's $1 million. And so you could have a very, very, very low hit rate and end up with these exponential sort of outcomes. But one of the coolest parts about that is you get to meet a lot of super energetic, optimistic people. And it tends to be young people, you know, but building these really interesting companies and, you know, wanting to change the world. A lot just want to get rich, but there's a lot of things involved in that world that makes it hard. I would love for someone to start a research boutique on the private space. We've talked about that a lot. Mm-hmm. We may have to do that if no one else does. I don't want to, but we may have to.
Well, I'm looking forward to hearing that podcast with Jason. That'll be
It'll be fun. And so, you know, we talked a lot about alts. And so a lot of people, that means different things, but we went down many a rabbit hole. So we'll open this back up next quarter for a couple weeks, if you missed it, to chat about other stuff as well.
Cool. I'm thinking here, why don't we hit on maybe a few Q&A from the listeners, and then we'll wrap it up.
Yep.
Correlation of market rise and breadth is an interesting relationship. Sometimes I see mentioned often, but I cannot help but think that indexation must have a not subtle effect on breadth. What are your thoughts? So but let me back up. Why don't you define everything, make sure everybody's on the same page.
Yeah, I mean,
first.
Breadth is like, if you look at the S&P 500, it's a lot of the traditional metrics and indicators are such that a classic one is, you know, how many are up or how many are down over a time frame or on the day or above their 200-day moving average. I was listening to Mark Yusko on Adventures in Finance podcast talk about the percentage of companies above the 200-day moving average is a great indicator.
Okay.
And so it's basically saying, you know, is the market being supported by just a handful of stocks? You know, there's a lot of talk of the FANGs, Facebook, Amazon, Netflix, Google, you know, lately. And it's because, particularly in the late 90s, that bull market was a small percent of the universe bubble. So it was the tech companies, but it wasn't small caps and it wasn't dividend paying value stocks, right? Those companies did not have a bear market 2002, 2003 at all. NASDAQ fell 85%. Every headline was terrible. The world was coming in. Most companies did just fine. And so breadth, you know, you start to see some divergences and it's kind of, you know, like this lattice work of information where a lot of times you're trying to put together different pieces and some things will give you hints sometimes and sometimes they won't. So I've long looked at breadth. I think it's interesting. You have to take into account, you can't just look at everything exchange traded. Tom McClellan, who's been on the podcast, does a lot of good work here because there'll be closed-end funds. There'll be ETFs, which happen to own bonds. There'll be, so you want a kind of pure universe and want it to be not survivor bias, all that good stuff. I've never found anything other than it being interesting and kind of coincident, but I'm sure lots of other people have. So it would be an indicator that I think is could be very helpful. Luthold writes a lot about it. They did in this current issue. If you can get access to Luthold's green book, it's like Christmas Eve every month when it comes. I love it. It's probably my favorite publication.
Well, given the specifics of this listener's questions, it seems like in addition to just questioning about breadth, he's asking about the effect of indexing on breadth. Do you find that that somehow dilutes the efficacy of this, or is it irrelevant?
You're starting to tread into my single least favorite media topic today, which is the index and passive and ETF flows. And it's often, I mean, Paul Singer just came out with one of the stupidest comments, but something like, you know, it's they're anti-capitalism. It's destroying capitalism. And it's what, such a
passivist?
ETFs. Oh, and ETFs. Just passive. It's so moronic and it's so ill-informed. And I'll give you a couple reasons. One, I mean, his argument, I think, is a little more that by indexing, you're removing a lot of the traditional active involvement to vote on issues and boards and shareholder activism. But the thing about markets is if a stock gets too far away from its intrinsic value, someone will come in and do something, you know? So he will come in and do something. He'll get 10 of his friends. If a stock, I guarantee you, if a stock gets too cheap, Warren Buffett will buy it. You know, there is no question that, so there's a couple things.
Isn't that the question though, is as indexing rises as much, does that basically take away the opportunity for single stock investors to, you know, correct those imbalances?
That makes no sense. On top of that, I mean, a lot of these active managers are complaining because they've been underperforming the market for a long time. And again, the whole active passive thing to me is a bit of a nonsensical debate, but meaning people that are trying to beat the market have struggled and they're pissed off because a lot of, because Vanguard is destroying them, which is awesome because these people charge way too much for doing very little. So I would think you would, but again, going back to the active funds hitting all time highs in AUM and having more fund launches than ETFs, mutual funds are still 5X ETF assets, 5X, not equal. You would, if you listen to the media, you would think that ETFs are like 100 times the size of mutual funds. Mutual funds are 5 times as big as ETFs. Mutual funds are 2/3 active. So this whole passive is eating the world thing, which is a good thing, is silly. If you look at institutional ownership of ETFs across pension funds, across asset managers, advisors, it's like 1% of their funds are in ETFs. Some it's less than 1%. And then I tweeted that out about a year ago. But at some point I give up and I just can't take it. I can't even engage.
You get so annoyed by this.
It's because it's just such bad homework. It's like you're not even, it's people writing about something and not even putting any thought into it whatsoever.
What was the quote? It was, the general idea was, it's not about active or passive. It all boils down to fees.
It's, well, you're totally mangling a Bogle quote, but it's close.
No, I don't think it was Bogle.
It's Bogle. And it said, the conflict of interest in the industry is not active versus passive. It's high cost versus low cost.
All right. Well, I just said it better. Whatever.
Yeah. New attribution, Jeff Rimsberg.
There you go.
August 2017.
Did I cut you off on this one? Is there more you want to say on it?
No, I didn't want to say anything on it, but I couldn't help myself.
All right. Next question. I will preface this by saying if you guys are interested in this following topic, listen to our podcast with Dave Nadig. I think he covered this in more detail. But the question is, I'd like to hear what you and Mev have to say about the ETF bubble. He's worried about downside liquidity during sell-offs, misallocation of capital to low ROIC companies, and yada, yada, yada.
I mean, it's kind of a tangential to the last question, yep. Namely that ETFs are just a wrapper. So people talk about stuff. They're like, oh, back during this last liquidity event or flash crash. No, that was stock driven. And we talked about that with Nadig. Stocks were the issue, not ETFs. So ETFs are the same, pretty much the same exact thing as mutual funds, closed-end funds, all these other wrappers. And that's all that it is. Mutual funds, the difference is they do it once a day. If they traded throughout the day, they'd look exactly like ETFs. Closed-end funds have no tie to net asset value, so they can trade around it. But they're all just wrappers and they own. And it really doesn't matter. The only exception is if you have a tiny asset class and a ton of money floating in, and even... We just talked about this with Emil Van Essen on commodities, where you put enough money to something, it will move the asset class. So if you have, you know, some tiny sub asset class like social media microcap stocks, and you decide to do an ETF on that, they would never get approved. But if you did, then you put $100 billion in it, it's going to affect the stocks. But for the vast majority of the world, it works great. And there's some areas like corporate bonds that probably shouldn't be like we would love to do a catastrophe bond fund, you know, on these reinsurers that insure risk for hurricanes and earthquakes because it correlates to nothing. You get a decent yield. They've been pushed to kind of lower yields now, but historically it's been a great asset class. You can't do that as an ETF. It's a terrible idea. Some people do it as mutual funds, but I think they have longer lockup. It could be a closed-end fund, but there's some assets that just makes no sense to put it into an ETF structure. So other than a tiny few areas, it's a totally fine structure.
All right, so sleep well. Third question, let's call it a day. Actually kind of ties into what we were discussing earlier in terms of market levels, valuation levels. With stretch valuations in the U.S. equity markets, is there any valuation level that the buyback component of the shareholder yield ratio could actually create a headwind for the strategy?
You know, I just listened to Patrick's Invest with the Best podcast with Thorndike, who wrote the book, The Outsiders. One of my favorite books. Buffett recommended it. If you haven't read it, go pick up a copy. And he talks a lot about dividends and buybacks and finding CEOs that, you know, are good capital allocators. And he says that, you know, the sexy part of a business and what everyone focuses 99% of the time on is operations. And, you know, what is this company doing? What products is it producing? Yada, yada. But really, he said a lot of the value is driven by capital allocation. Some of the best CEOs, when their stock was expensive, you know, they would be net sellers and acquiring other companies for stock. And then when their stock was cheap, they would be buying it back, et cetera. So you'd like to see people that are agnostic. Now, so there's kind of two challenges. One is that, and we just saw finally a competitor finally come in and is launching another, I think it's BlackRock, launching a shareholder yield style fund, which I'm pretty sure doesn't include valuation. So any of these ways of doing dividends or buybacks or the correct way, which is both, if you ignore valuation, I think it is very foolish. Because it doesn't matter if you're buying a stock that's buying back stock, a company that's buying back stock, or a company that's paying high dividends. If that stock's expensive, it's a stupid idea. It doesn't matter if they're distributing cash flow. Like, you want to be buying cheap first, you know, then doing correct investment decisions. And the only way in my mind, you know, that we try to do it is through objective measures. Now, if you're talking about the stock market as a whole, you know, you tend to see a general trend of buybacks that ebb and flow with the market cycle. You know, you see more in 07 than you do in 08 or 09. And then it kind of comes back up and you see a lot more buybacks over the last few years. That's on aggregate though. And you really don't care about on aggregate what the distributions are, because remember, buybacks are the same as dividends over time, excluding taxes. So it's not something I sweat. There's two separate questions. Is the market overvalued? And then if you're picking stocks in the stock market, are you picking cheap ones?
Well, to what degree is the answer to this question not far simpler? Is just anything above intrinsic value is overpaying.
Right. So you don't want this U.S. stock market in general in the first place. So you can apply shareholder yield to foreign developed and emerging, and it works great. It has been working great. But it's probably the value lever that's working more. And, you know, that's, we always say the big muscle movement is value rather than, and we've done enough ad nauseum on this on dividends. the way to think about it, U.S. stock market's going to return less than normal. Let's call it 3%, maybe. Who knows? 4%, 5% if you're an optimist. We did a great post the other day that I forgot about this. I was looking at my Twitter feed and it had like Bogle, Shiller, GMO, and like Hussman and some other just famous investors. We had the historical rate of return on the stock market, 6.7% real. So round that up to 9 or 10 nominal. But 6.7% real, every single one of them was below. You know, but what do investors expect? Through all the surveys, they expect 10% plus return. So misalignment. So you just have lower expectations. And then you can say, hey, look, if we're buying the cheap stocks within that stock market, add a percent or two or whatever. I'm being cautious here, but adding a few percent above the market return. So you'll still hopefully beat the market because you're buying the cheap stuff, but that market may not be giving you the opportunities. Not enough breadth. That's why you want to look globally.
There you go. All right. We're sitting at an hour. Anything else that you want to chat about before we wrap up?
Lots, but we'll hold off for another radio show. And listeners, the more questions you send in to Jeff, the more chance you have for us doing a lot more radio shows. We may do these once a week because we have so many guests lined up over the next 2 months that are awesome. We kind of have to either add them as supplements or boot some of the guests down the line. And there's so many people we want to talk to. I really don't want to boot them. So send questions to Jeff. Feedback at themedfabershow.com. I think we've crossed 200 reviews.
Finally? Have we? Good.
I don't know. I saw it at like 197 a couple weeks ago and I haven't looked since. So I hope so.
We're over 1.5 million total downloads, which is another little milestone.
So that means of the 1.5 million downloads, about 0.0001% of you have left a review. So Jeff and I put a lot of work and sweat. I'm particularly sweat. The radio room doesn't have air conditioning somehow. And so it's like 105 degrees in here. Anyway, we put a lot of effort. We would love to see your reviews. We love reading them. They're a lot of fun. More fun than my first book, the new book review that got taken down by Amazon.
That was great.
So good. Sorry you guys missed it. But the guy was complaining about the price of the book at $15. No, he's complaining about the price of the book at $25, even though the Kindle is $15, not having read the book, not having ordered it. And then he said, greet anyone, which is even funnier because all the proceeds go to charity. So anyway, send us an email, feedback at themedfavorite.show.com. Please leave us a review. We love reading them. You can always find the episodes, show notes, yada, yada, at medfavor.com/podcast. Thanks for listening, friends, and good investing.